One of the most soaring voices in the world has taken a dive. The voice belongs to Placido Domingo, and the dive is into the deeper reaches of that voice. This fall in Berlin, the great tenor is singing a leading role as a baritone. Fans have come from all over Europe to hear it. Domingo? A baritone? Well, he is 68 years old, and voices do tend to get lower as they age. But still, we had some questions about this transformation, so we turned to our music commentator, Miles Hoffman. Good morning.
Good morning, Renee.
And Miles, let's keep listening to Placido Domingo as a baritone.
Renee, that's Domingo singing the Verdi role of Simon Boccanegra. He was singing that at the Berlin State Opera. Domingo will be singing this all over Europe, actually, and he'll be singing at the Metropolitan Opera in 2010, again, as a baritone in Simon Boccanegra.
Well, yeah, there was a review in the Times of London that speculated as to why Domingo might be doing this. And its quip was that the singer might be aiming to end his career on a low note. that in a way, this right. He's trying to make sense career-wise out of some natural progression as far as his voice is.
Well, and that's true. But it's also a natural progression that went in the other direction, Renee. First of all, Domingo is a very interesting and intellectually curious and ambitious musician. He's always tried different things. And he has always had a rich lower register to his voice. And in fact, Placido Domingo started out his career as a baritone. He started as a baritone. And somewhere along the line, early on actually, people said, you know, Placido, I think you should try to sing tenor because that seems to be what your voice is even better suited for.
Why don't we listen then to the difference by taking a listen to someone who's made a career as a baritone?
I think that's a good idea, Renee. We can do a little A-B comparison. From the opera Simon Boccanegra, singing the same role, here is the great Italian baritone, Pier Cappuccilli. And now let's hear Domingo singing the same thing.
He really does sound, if you could put it that way, it's quite a pretty voice, but
exactly.
Less rich than Cappuccilli.
It's a beautiful voice and always has been. And in fact, Renee, the ranges, the actual pitch ranges, the notes that tenors and baritones sing are not that very different. What's different is the quality. Baritones have a richer, lower, darker quality. And when they sing up high, it sounds like somebody with a low voice trying to sing high. When Domingo sings high, it's easy for him. But one of the things we should stress here, Renee, is that different tenors have different qualities. If you listen to somebody like Pavarotti, Pavarotti never had that deep quality at the bottom of his voice. And Domingo never sang just bunches of high C's one after the other. Yeah, well, that's Pavarotti, Renee.
Yeah.
A totally different sound from Domingo.
Well, are you saying then in a way that singers are prisoners of the vocal cords that they were born with?
A little bit. Here's the thing. I'm never going to sound like James Earl Jones. And I can sing low notes, but I'm never going to sound like a basso. I'm not going to sound like a deep bass singer. Frankly, neither am I going to sound like a tenor, but that's a different story. We are born with certain physical equipment. What's interesting is that singers develop, and students starting out usually have to figure out at some point what their voice type is. They don't start out necessarily knowing their voice type. You see students in music schools arriving all the time having to figure out, am I a tenor, am I a baritone, am I a soprano, am I a mezzo-soprano?
Well, now, you've just mentioned sopranos. We've been talking about tenors and baritones. But assuming, of course, that everything you've just been saying is true for women singers as well?
It is, absolutely. A wonderful example of somebody who is in some ways like Domingo would be the great soprano Maria Callas. She was famous for that aria. That's the aria Una Voce Poco Fa from Rossini's Barber of Seville. That's a coloratura, high aria. Now let's hear her sing a mezzo-soprano aria from Camille Saint-Saëns' opera Samson and Delilah. Callas, like Domingo, had this extraordinarily rich lower register, lower range, so she could do this. She could go from one to the other.
Well, apparently the opera world will be getting both from Plácido Domingo in the coming years because his opera roles now are booked, as I understand it, 5 years into the future, and he's going to mix in now both tenor and baritone roles.
That's right. That's right, Renee. And it might be fun to go out with a recording of Domingo singing one of the most famous baritone roles in the repertoire, the role of Figaro in Rossini's Barber of Seville. And this is the Largo al Factotum, where he sings Figaro, 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 Figaro.
And Miles, thank you, thank you, thank you.
Thank you, Renee.
Sorry to interrupt those Figaros. Just a reminder that that was Miles Hoffman, violist of the American Chamber Players and dean of the Petrie School of Music at Converse College in Spartanburg, South Carolina. To hear more Plácido Domingo at both ends of his voice range, go to npr.org/music. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
In the 1950s, a young man who'd been on the upward track of success as part of a quartet with his brothers performed alone in the seediest of nightclubs after the family act broke up. He sang the wrong kinds of songs for the wrong kinds of audiences, and he was continually stiffed by club owners. At one point, he got so hungry he ate dog food. But he became iconic in American popular culture with more than 20 platinum and gold albums, 20 years in Las Vegas, a television run that surpassed 10 years, 7 decades of show business.
Moon River, wider than a mile.
The singer was Andy Williams, of course. His career charts like a history of mid-20th century entertainment. At 82, Andy Williams still tours and performs year-round, often at his Moon River Theater in Branson, Missouri. He has a new memoir, Moon River and Me, that's candidly fresh and very frank, and Andy Williams joins us now just seconds after you got off the stage at your Moon River Theater in Branson. Do you ever stop? You have a phenomenal amount of energy.
Well, I try not to stop. If I stop, I don't know whether I'll start again.
You have a big book because you've had a big, long career. Would you take us back to the era of live radio performance, I should say? The Williams brothers got their start in the big city of Des Moines on the Iowa Barn Dance Frolic and later on the National Barn Dance out of WLS in Chicago. Did you guys sing all the jingles for products at the same time?
Well, we had a jingle that was on a show in Cincinnati, Ohio, on WLW. We had a show called It's Time to Shine, sponsored by Griffin Shoe Polish. And we had a jingle every morning that went, bong, 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 it's time to shine. So shine your shoes and you wear a smile. Shine your shoes and you'll be in style. Sun shines east and the sun shines west. Griffin polish shines the best. Some folks are not particular how they look around the feet, but if they wore shoes upon their heads, they'd make sure their shoes looked neat. So keep your shoes shining all the time. All the time is the time to shine. When you hear the familiar chime, bong, 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 everybody gets it, it's time to shine. Well, it wasn't an easy song to sing either, as you can tell by the way I was doing it.
I love the way I really had to twist your arm to get you to do that.
Well,
But it's interesting that your father envisioned you being in the movie business, and you thought he had just lost his mind and wanted to move you to Los Angeles.
Well, my brother Bob, who was always pessimistic about every move we made, you know, like, he'd say, well, we can't go on the radio in a big city like Chicago. And we'd go and we'd get on the radio in Chicago. When we moved to Cincinnati, we can't move to Cincinnati. It's a big station, WLW, and it's 500,000 watts a night. We can't ever do that. Then when he said, we're going to go to California, you're going to be in the movies. He said, we can't be in the movies. We're not actors. Why would anybody want to buy a ticket to see us? You know. And then, but my father, his vision for us was, it wasn't my passion to be a singer. It was really his passion to have his boys sing. And, you know, in the long run, I'm very glad that he instilled that in me and got me to do it.
You actually, once you got to Los Angeles, hooked up with Bing Crosby. Was that your big break?
Well, that was one of the first ones. That's the first thing we did when we went to California. We met up with Bing and we made this record called Swingin' on a Star. It became a big, big hit for Bing Crosby and the Williams Brothers. And that was the first recording we ever made.
To fool up people is his only thought. And though he's slippery, he still gets caught.
But then if that sort of life is what you wish, you may grow up to be a fish.
So much of the Williams Brothers' early success is linked to performing with the entertainer Kay Thompson. Now, a lot of people may not know her name, but they certainly know her work. She's the author of the Eloise books, Eloise at the Plaza, which she wrote while staying with you guys.
Yeah,
she
wrote that while we were working in the Persian Room at the Plaza Hotel. But she was very influential in all of our careers. She's the one that got us interested in reading books, and she's the one that got us interested in art. And me in particular, I went up and down 57th Street in New York every day when I was there, and went in every art gallery, and just to become familiar with Picasso and Braque and Juan Gris and all of those cats. That's how I started getting interested in art. And then once I got interested in it, I was hooked. I became a collector.
You know, you had such success as a quartet with your brothers that it was shocking to read how utterly miserable you were as a solo act out on the road in the 1950s.
Yeah, and when I went out on my own, when my brothers decided they wanted to do other things, I was already 24 years old and never thought of being a soloist. But I didn't know how to do anything else but sing. So I went out and Kay helped me with an act. And so the material that she had me do was really should have been in the Persian Room at the Plaza Hotel. Instead, I was working these dumps, you know, in Cleveland and Pittsburgh and Philadelphia and Akron and, you know, any place that I could get a job, you know, with coal miners watching me and not caring what they were seeing at all, because I was doing Mad Dogs and Englishmen, and I was a song and dance man and did old George Gershwin songs. And I kept at it for about 3 years until I finally decided, you know, this thing isn't working at all. I'm a little slow. It took me about 3 years to figure out that what I really should be doing is try and sing songs like Perry Como and Frank Sinatra and be a pop singer.
Riding along, floating through space.
You were fortunate to come along with the rise of television variety shows, and you really took to it. And it is really quite amazing to see how the timing comes together here, because you're starting out just as Steve Allen is starting out with The Tonight Show, and then later you get your own show. Some of the people that debuted on your show, Elton John, The Beach Boys, Linda Ronstadt, Jimmy Buffett, and, of course, The Osmonds.
That's right. You know, when you have your own show and it's a popular show, people want to get on it for one reason or another. Like Elton John had just recorded his first record. His agent was my agent, and he pleaded with me to put him on. I said, I really don't want this guy on there, even though I don't know him. And he said, you've got to do this for me. So I said, all right.
It's a little bit funny, this feeling inside.
We'd record one 3 weeks before it was going to go on the air, and then that gave NBC time to promote it and publicize it. So by the time that show went on, his record was in the top 10 or top 20 at least, and it was a big coup to have him on.
I buy a big house where
we both could live. If I was a sculptor.
Now, I know that you're a lifelong Republican, so I was moved to read about your very close friendship with Bobby Kennedy. I hadn't realized how close you were.
Yeah, we were friends, very good friends, and it wasn't a political friendship. I mean, I had been brought up a Republican, and that didn't make any difference to me. I just loved Bobby. I just thought he was great. And I did a little work for him. I did some campaigning.
You were actually with Robert Kennedy on the night that he was assassinated, that you were, in fact, at the hotel in California where he was shot.
I was. And we were supposed to meet him right after he left the stage, right after he left the podium at the Ambassador Hotel. And then he was shot, and, of course, we went to the hospital right away. We stayed with the body, came back on Air Force One, and looked up the Battle Hymn of the Republic in the Encyclopedia Britannica, and the next day, or the day after, I sang that at his funeral.
Right. Andy Williams, you work at a relentless pace. You're talking to us just seconds after you got off the stage in Branson. Once you pass the age of 60, why did you decide to open your own theater in Branson, Missouri, and not just retire?
Well, I was really burned out about doing the same things that I'd been doing, doing all the touring, working Caesar's Palace again, working all the gambling casinos. And about that time, my brother Don called me, and he said he was in Branson, Missouri. He said, you ought to come down and see what this is like down here. He said that 4 million people come to see these country people perform in the theaters. He said, I think you'll do really well. And I decided to build a theater that was different than the others, make it more like a theater and gallery, art museum. And I was newly married, and I was in New York City with my new wife, Debbie. And we've been together now 23 years. And I said, honey, we're going to go to Branson, Missouri. And she said, you're absolutely crazy. Why do you want to go down there? I said, I want to start a new life with you. And we built this theater. Built a beautiful home on the water. I've got 3 great dogs that I love, all rescue dogs, and we're happy as clams.
Is it at all possible to ask you, sir, to sing a song for us?
To sing a song for you?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'll sing the Moon River, wider than a mile. I'm crossing you in style someday. That's about it for $1.50.
Thank you so much for being with us.
You're welcome. I enjoyed talking to you.
You heartbreaker, wherever you're going, I'm going your way.
Andy Williams' new memoir is called Moon River and Me. You can listen to more of our conversation online. Andy Williams recounts his days as a young, truly starving artist. And he even sings another song for us. That's on our website, nprmusic.org. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. Leanne Hansen returns next week for her 20th anniversary as host of this program. I'm Jackie Leiden.
My huckleberry friend.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, we dig into the pages of the Washington Post magazine, and we hear about a woman who inherited a surprise windfall from a former teacher, a gift that came with no strings attached and no explanation. We'll hear more in a moment. But first, a special mom's conversation with a mom who is also a Grammy Award-winning singer.
I will cross the ocean for you. Let your way for all time. Promise you.
That was Monica singing, of course, for You, I Will from the 1996 movie Space Jam. Now, you might know her for any number of reasons. Her hit duet with Brandy, The Boy Is Mine, which remains one of the most popular singles in history, according to the Billboard charts, or her guest appearances from such television shows as Living Single or American Dreams. But in her off hours, Monica has a very different life. She is the mother of two young sons. She's trying to keep her relationship strong with her partner and the father of her boys, rapper Rodney Rocco Hill Jr., as well as produce a fifth album. And now she's bringing her fans into all of her worlds as the star of a new reality show airing on BET called Still Standing. And Monica is with us now from Atlanta. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You know, it seems that reality shows have become quite the thing these days. Did you have any hesitation about doing it?
Actually, I just flat out said no in the beginning. I thought if my life wasn't very dramatic with drama-filled situations all the time, that it wouldn't be interesting. So after we talked, and only after James Dubose and I talked, I realized that they were looking for a show that was about a person that had experienced a lot.
James Dubose being the producer of both the
absolutely.
Album and the program.
He's the producer of the television show. He created a lot of other shows, but I just didn't want people to be hung up on the different tests and trials. And then he explained, no, I've seen you on different occasions, and I see the way that you are with your children. I see the way that you are about your work, you know, and the fact that you started at 12 years old, you know, makes me feel like there's a lot to the story that people don't know. And the great part about the show for me, he understood a lot of the ways that I felt in my views, and me being so solely based on my faith, everything, the foundation of everything that I do is my faith. So when we started talking, you know, the comfortability just came after that.
Well, let's talk about some of the things that you have going on now, because as I mentioned, one of the things that's interesting that I think will be interesting to a lot of people about this series is that you are a working mom, but you happen to work in a particular field, okay,
right,
which is music. It's kind of a critical time in your career. This is your fifth album that you're putting together, and it hasn't been the easiest time. I mean, you've had some, you know, monster hits in the 90s, but subsequently things haven't always been as smooth, in part because, as comes clear in the series, you haven't always felt that you've been showcased in the way that you want to be. I just want to play a short clip from the series where you're talking to your producer about what you're trying to accomplish with this album, and here it is.
What was that?
That was the joint I was talking about.
Do you really feel like that record sounded like me? I don't. It's like I almost thought you might have been playing something on somebody else that you just needed to like listen to for a hot minute, because I know you didn't think that I need to record that song.
Tell me more about that. Was that a difficult conversation to have,
when
particularly
I get angry
in front of other people?
You know what it is? Each of my albums have been great examples of where I was at that particular time. On the fourth album, we released a single. The label felt that it was the right song for me, and myself and the producer of the song, which was Jermaine Dupri, said no. And that album, The Makings of Me, my very last one, it did not sell like the other ones. So the passion that you hear, it's not that I don't respect the producers, but they can go on and produce hit after hit, or one may not work, they can move on. It doesn't have the same effect on a producer as it does an artist. But what I did recognize is that I should not record songs that aren't true to who I am, because if they do become singles, if they do get out to the masses, and that is not what the audience that has supported me for almost 15 years wants, then you suffer the consequences. And that's what happened the last time.
Let's talk about the kids for a minute, if we can. You're the proud mom of two young boys. Very adorable. And I just want to play a short clip of you talking about them.
No matter what I got going on, that's not my children's issue. Being a mom is my greatest accomplishment yet. I've never felt the kind of love that I felt after having my children. But my two sons, Rocco, Romello, I experienced it. And it's scary, but it feels real, real good.
Talk to me about that. What's scary?
Well, when I say scary, I mean it's scary that you can love someone more than you love yourself, or love them so much that you'll sacrifice anything that you can for them. You know, that's scary when you think about it, you know, because your children do need that. They need your unconditional love. But sometimes I have to say, okay, Mom, chill out. He's at school. Give it a rest. You know, I have to kind of check myself sometimes, because it's just a natural thing for me. My mom was always very, very loving, very affectionate, compassionate. So I wanted to be that way with my children, but I'm also a lot more protective because I experienced more than she did. She grew up in the country with a lot of siblings where things happen in a very structured way. I grew up in the city where peer pressure, death, danger was all around.
You alerted earlier to some of the things that you've gone through in your life, in addition to the hits that many people will remember and know about. Some people will also remember that you went through a very difficult period back in the year 2000 when your then boyfriend killed himself in your presence. And I think a lot of people would just like to know how you recovered from that.
You know, God is so awesome. And as I think about the things that happened in my life, especially that particular incident, it was the love of my family, and it was them reminding me that, yeah, at a lot of points in your life, you've strayed from what you've known, and what you've known is the right thing, and he's forgiven. He's so awesome that he gives you a second, a third, a fourth, and fifth chance, but you have to develop your own relationship with Christ again. And that was something that my mom used to always tell me, find a quiet place where you can speak to God and just recreate your own relationship with him. And that's what I would do. And I say about 6 to 8 weeks after the incident, I started feeling his presence taking over me. You know, and I would suggest to anybody to have some type of spirituality that they can cling to and find some type of solace when things just get really rough.
I wanted to ask, though, about a couple more things, if you have a couple more minutes for us. This whole
Absolutely.
Question of how you balance being a mom with the demands of a career in which your sexiness is often the draw. But I know that you're in a field where sometimes women feel as they get older, as they take on more family responsibilities, particularly if they're very protective of their family time, feel that they're at a disadvantage. Do you ever feel that way? And what's your plan? How are you going to handle that?
You know, I told them, I explained to everybody around me from the television show when we went in. I say this, I said it when I went in to work on my new deal for my new album. My kids come first. People have made the accommodations because I think people do respect family. You know, when you say the reasoning for why things are that way, you know, it's mandatory that I'm in places that have kitchens. The kitchen is not for me. The kitchen is because I still fix my kids' meals. You know, and I think people can appreciate it because they know it's not some diva attitude or some unnecessary stuff that I need. You know, they see the boys, they're 4-1. So they still have certain requirements, you know, on a regular basis.
What about marriage? Do you think that might
marriage
be part
is going to
happen
very soon?
Really?
Absolutely. 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 You know, it was something I did it very differently than most women. I've never, ever mentioned the word marriage to him. I let him mention it to me. And
him being
Rodney, my fiance,
who's the father of your boys.
We've known each other for 9 years. So we're very comfortable with one another in ways that are hard to sometimes even explain because we were only 19 when we met. So as we went into our relationship and our first son was born, I was 24 years old. And, you know, he said something about us getting married then, you know, and then once our second son was born, 2.5 years later, he just told me, you know, this is what I want for us. This is what I want for our family. And of course, you know, by me reading the word, we know that that was not the proper order. And we recognize that. And God has forgiven us. And we both moved on from it. So us looking to being married is something that I'm really excited about.
Monica is the star of a new docudrama reality program, whatever you want to call it. It airs on BET. It's called Still Standing. That is also the title of her new album, which is expected in January. And Monica was kind enough to join us from her home base in Atlanta. Monica, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much.